Now, before we move on, we've got Glenn on the line who wants to make a comment about Ebola and quarantine, since that was the last discussion at the end of the last hour. Hello, Glenn.
Hello there. Couple interesting things with this. I wanted to point out the patient under treatment on a hospital isolation unit is considered to be under quarantine.
Right.
Quarantine isn't necessarily tantamount to utter abandonment. Somebody can be under quarantine.
Right.
And then the other thing is that in terms of treatment, we've seen some progress this CMAP thing, but even more promising. And then this is what I expect they'll end up treating this nurse down in Dallas. As a matter of fact, I think she's over to see some. Is the convalescent plasma, blood plasma with the immune components from someone who has recovered. And there was some question when Duncan died, as to why he hadn't been made privy to. I've heard people question, well, why didn't he get ZMAP or why didn't he get a blood transfusion? And then I heard a supposed explanation that they didn't have any of a compatible blood type. And after which I heard an epidemiologist explain that since the erythrocytes, the red cells, are spun off, the cells are separated from the plasma, it doesn't have to be a compatible blood type, which sort of re-raises the question. But
in my view, he should not have been treated. He should not have been treated in the United States. All it does is encourage other people to come here who are infected with the disease and lie in the process and make other innocent people susceptible to the disease. And I am told that the problem with ZMAP as it relates to giving it to individuals is that it is in very limited supply. It takes considerable time to make. And of those who have received ZMAP thus far, the survival rate of the recipients of ZMAP has only been slightly better than the overall survival rate of the disease of the virus. And you would expect higher survival rates on the disease if the victim is being cared for in an environment where they're given every possible benefit. As opposed to sitting there in a bed, drowning in their own bodily fluids in Liberia. So really the question is still out, is whether ZMAP is going to be an effective cure.
Right. I have to compliment the government of Liberia. If Duncan had survived, the government of Liberia was going to prosecute him.
It's
very wise on their part because...
Of course.
Because that way that does keep them from becoming a pariah nation in the eyes of other nations. You know?
Correct. It was absolutely the right thing to do. And unfortunately, America, as it typically does, did everything wrong as it relates to this individual. We were talking about how much we were trying to help him when in fact we ought to have isolated him immediately, not cared for him, and not made America more vulnerable or these individuals more vulnerable based upon his grotesquely immoral behavior.
Right. Now, this convalescent plasma thing is potentially very, very promising, especially since as people survive, as the number of people infected and the people survive, the more and more survivors there are, the more and more, the people you have eligible to do the plasma donation, which is in itself very simple. So that right now, that's the most promising.
So long as you, it's in Liberia, there is a black market for the blood.
That's not the same at all.
But there is a black market in Liberia for the blood of Ebola survivors. And that is a very, very, very dangerous treatment, and that is more likely to cause problems than it is to solutions.
They'll die of other diseases. They'll be transmitting other diseases, even if you survive. And if you don't type and cross that right, you'll end up with you'll end up dying of anaphylaxis. So yeah, that's bad news.
Yes,
I don't think I'd want blood from anywhere in Africa.
No, the HIV rate in Africa is through the roof. I mean, there are countries in Africa that 60% of the population has HIV. It's one of the things, for example, that I wanted my sons to have the same experience that I had and to be able to go on a photographic safari of the great Tanzanian and Kenyan game reserves. And to do that now is there's very high risk associated with it, because if you are injured, the propensity of you to get blood that is tainted with HIV is really high, and so you almost can't do what you would once was a great thrill of a lifetime.
We tried to dissuade him, but a family member of mine is just returning from one of such trips.
Yeah, and the other problem you have both in Tanzania and Kenya, they are majority Christian and not Muslim nations, they have very active, very ruthless Muslim contingencies that are perpetrating horrific acts of terrorism vis-a-vis the mall in Kenya where so many people were massacred based upon Muslims going berserk. Of course, they're not real Muslims, according to the Abominator. It's amazing how many non-Muslims are acting like Muslims around the world and doing things that are Islamic, but not Islamic by the Abominator's definition.
And those non-Muslims always seem to cry out Allahu Akbar, you know?
I've yet to find a religion that has an Allah or a God who wants to be considered greater. Just the whole concept of Allahu Akbar is that Allah is greater, bigger, and older. And you'd say, all right, if it's supposed to be a monotheistic religion, if that's its great claim, then the one thing you could never say is that my God is older, bigger, and greater. Greater, older, and bigger than whom? If it's a monotheistic religion. But that's not Islam's purpose. Islam's purpose is to have Allah, who was modeled after Satan, be considered higher than Yahweh. Greater than Yahweh. That's the entire purpose, which is why they scream Allahu Akbar. It's an extremely simple religion to understand when your perspective is correct on it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you, Glenn, on the comments on Ebola. Well, I'm hoping that, yes, that they do find treatments for Ebola that have a reasonable rate of success. But between now and then, between now and the time that we have a treatment for Ebola that is effective, then the best thing to do is isolation, is to isolate those who have Ebola from those who do not. And because of the nature of this disease, the number, the death toll, which, you know, right now is very high, you know, 4,500 people have contracted and died of Ebola. But if we do not isolate those who have been exposed to and have contracted the disease, that number isn't going to stay at 4,500. It's going to be in the tens of thousands. And when you think of the consequence to those who have not yet been infected with the disease, you're being incredibly merciless when your approach is in opposition to isolation. I'm going to return to Paul's statement. It's recorded now in the 13th verse of the first chapter of Galatians, where he said that he has been and is continuing to be a merciless individual, a man who devastated other humans, who annihilated other humans, who undermined and ravaged other humans, and was continuing to do so, and that the humans that he chose to devastate, to annihilate, to overpower, to undermine, to ravage, to destroy, were the called out of God, which would be the covenant's children. And he said, "For you have heard of my behavior in some past time and place, in the practice of Judaism." Now, he is claiming that this hideous behavior on his part is the fault of Judaism, that it's a consequence of Judaism, that it's an essential part of Judaism to be ruthless. Nothing could be further from the truth. Now, I do not want anyone listening to this to infer that I am suggesting that Judaism is a good religion because it is not violent. Judaism is a nonviolent religion, to be sure, but it does not make it good. It's still rotten. All religions are rotten. It's just that Paul's portrayal of Judaism is completely erroneous. He's lying. It was not his practice of Judaism that made him a murderer. He was a murderer because he was a disgusting person. It is just like the seventh chapter of Romans, where Paul says that he became an uncontrolled sexual pervert because of the Torah. That's a lie. The Torah did not make Paul a sexual pervert. He was repulsive. But his repulsiveness had to do with his own lack of character. The same thing is true here. So when we read this, you should immediately recognize that Paul is lying, that he is blaming a religion for his despicable behavior. Some time and place in the practice of Judaism, namely that because throughout and accordingly showing superiority, surpassing any measure of restraint, I was aggressively and intensely pursuing the called out of God. And I was and I am devastating her, continuing to annihilate her. Now, if you're wondering why Paul would admit to these awful things, especially since they are not true. Now, is it possible that Paul was a murderer? Yeah, possible. He's admitting it to it. Is it possible that he murdered based upon Judaism? No. That's a complete lie. But why would he admit to this? And I'm telling you that the only rational conclusion is that he thought that the comparison between the old Shaul, the Jewish Pharisee, and the new Paulos of the great apostle of the Christian religion would serve to demonstrate the relative merits of the old system compared to his new system. Now, if you think that's thin, I'm here to tell you that that's the basis of Islam. Islam concocted this time of ignorance that artificially portrays Arabians as despicable, so that the enlightenment of Islam produced this more moral condition. Yeah, it's not true. You see, in Islam, the reality is, and Muslim clerics know it, that Islam caused Arabs to be inhuman. It destroyed their conscience. In the first 10 years of the Islamic era, in the areas of Arabia within camel ride of Mecca and Medina, the first Muslims engaged in 75 terrorist raids. They were despicable. They engaged in decapitations, hundreds of them, as public spectacle. They raped little girls. They enslaved little boys. They robbed everyone. They were mass murderers. They took over what was a fairly peaceful, albeit backwards, community of people that eked out a living the best they could in very harsh conditions, and they turned them into absolute savages. That's what Islam did. It's why the first 100 years of the Islamic era after Muhammad's death is so savage. Hundreds of millions of people murdered, raped, robbed, enslaved. Islam radically changed Arabs, making them the most vicious and inhuman people on earth. And prior to Islam, they'd been, well, the best way I can say this is I investigated the history of the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Assyrians, the Egyptians, the Israelis, and I could not find a single historical artifact, a single historical account that shows Arabs pre-Islam leaving Arabia to rape, enslave, rob, torment non-Arabians. Not a single account. And yet, from the time that Muhammad invented and perpetrated Islam on Arabians, they became ruthless savages to their own first and then to everyone that they could reach in the world. And so what Islam did is it said, okay, so, you know, maybe we are a little militant, we're a little thievery-oriented here, maybe we are a little murderous, maybe we are a little rapist-oriented, maybe we are a little rough around the edges here, but you should have seen how bad the situation was before Islam. Oh, that was the time of ignorance. That was the time of grotesque immorality. And what we have now, by comparison, is wonderful. No, it's not. And what a pathetic justification. But that's what Muslims are told. And they're told that routinely. They believe it. And that's what Paul is promoting here. Paul never changed. You read his letters, they're all belligerent. He's obnoxious. He's vile. He wants to condemn anyone who disagrees with him. He's just a very mean, despicable, ornery, and perverted individual. He doesn't change. His whole life is that way. That's why at the end of his life, he's writing his lover, Timothy, and saying, Timmy, everybody has abandoned me. I have no friends, nobody. He was a horrible person. And so what he's trying to accomplish here is to say, but you think that I'm horrible now? You should have seen how bad I was before I invented this religion. And I was annihilating people. I was even worse when I was Jewish. So the great transformation now that I'm only horrible instead of totally despicable. The transformation of religion. And the same thought is used today. It's one of the greatest of all inducements to faith. These Christians, particularly evangelical Christians, have this thing called their testimony, where they will get up and they will say, you know, I was really terrible. And I had one of these because you're as a Christian, you had to have one. I was really bad. But then I found Jesus. And once I found Jesus, all that bad, it went away. And, you know, I've been transformed. I found faith. Well, Russell Wilson just wrote a thing for Jeter's website about how he was a thug. But then he found faith. He became a good boy. So Paul is trying to make this comparison that under the old system, which he compares to Judaism, that he was a murderous dude. He was really bad, out of control, sexual pervert and a mass murderer. But under his New Testament, under his new deal, he's a relative saint. A very common practice and religion to make these comparisons, although the comparisons are wholly fabricated.
Also a pretty common thing for a con man to do. Used to be like that, but not anymore.
Not anymore.
I'm on the straight and narrow now.
I used to take advantage of orphans and widows, but not anymore. No, now I take advantage of rich people because they got more money.
I don't do it anymore. I'm not doing it any less either, but not anymore.
I'm not doing it any less. Oh, that's funny. Of course, the verb that Paul chose to use in this particular admission and confession says that he is still doing it. And so he was doing it, and I'm still doing it, is the verb choice that he chose. Now, these are serious deeply troubling issues, which Paul has written about himself. And they just should never be passed over. Particularly when he uses hyperbole, the Greek word. You know, it's a Greek word that's been translated into English to explain how out of control he was. He says, you know, showing, surpassing any measure of restraint, hyperbole, that he was dioko, aggressively and intently, intense with great intensity, pursuing an portheo, devastating and annihilating. This is really bad, folks. When this is scribed in the imperfect and directed at God's children, you know, you may want to find a different spokesperson for how you should relate to God than a man who admits to this kind of behavior. Now, had Paul wanted to say that he had been conceited, that he had been out of control and intensely aggressive in the past while annihilating, which is to murder en masse, God's covenant children, he would have used the perfect tense, which describes actions which were completed in the past, which led to the present state of affairs. The fact that he didn't not only confirms that his assault on the covenant was ongoing and indeed never ending, but that he had no respect for his audience, believing that they were so inferior to his intellect that they'd never hold him accountable for what he just wrote, no matter how obvious he made it for them. You know, when Paul says, I am demon-possessed, which he does in his second letter to the Corinthians, I mean, you can't make it any more obvious than that. And yet, he's just poking his finger in your eye and saying, you are so stupid that you're going to buy into my religion even when I admit it. When he said that he was insane, read right through it. When he said he was a mass murderer of God's covenant children, well, so what? That was Judaism. When he said that the Torah is what caused him to be a sexual pervert, that's just an example. When he wrote that Rome's government was put in place by God and was for good and that you should submit to it, the very Rome that was about to not only destroy the temple, but to use the money found in the temple, the wealth of the temple, to build the most despicable place on earth, to re-enslave God's children, the Jews, and have them use the funds to buy the building materials to construct the Roman Colosseum, the most hideous example of man's inhumanity to man, probably ever to scar this earth. And they can't figure it out. When Hadrian, as the head of this Roman government, considered one of the great Roman emperors of all time, came to Jerusalem to rename it after himself and to build a temple for himself on top of the Temple Mount. And you've got Paul saying, yeah, all governments are put in place by God in his letter to the Romans about the Roman government and that you should submit to them. And you're not smart enough to figure out that that's not inspired, that's not sane, that's not right. And I guess you deserve your fate. You know, they don't call it smart. They don't call it logical. They call it faith. They don't call it reasonable. They call it religion.
Well, they don't have a choice in anything that happens. It's all destined to be.
Yeah, predestination. You get predestination from Pauline Christianity. That's why old Calvin came up with it. But you know, Calvin is associated with Protestant Christianity, and particularly with the Presbyterians. But Augustine, you know, he's a patron saint of Roman Catholicism. You know, he's Saint Augustine to the Roman Catholics, and Augustine was also under predestination. So your point is well taken that Augustine's, who's almost all of his writings were focused on what Paul had to say. He just loved Paul. Well, he came up with the same concept of predestination. Islam is predestined too. Allah makes all of the choices. Muhammad goes out of his way in the hadith to say, no, everything is predestined. It was all based on a back rub. You know, Allah rubbed Adam's back, and all of those that were destined to heaven came off to the right side, and all the souls that were destined to hell were off onto the left side, and so your fate is already determined. So, I mean, why go off and die as a jihadist if your fate is determined? They call it religion, not reason. But in Christianity, you know, Pauline Christianity is into predestination, which is the antithesis of Yahweh's covenant. And if God is predestined to your fate, if he has a plan and he's going to impose his plan on you, then there's no purpose in thinking, reasoning, reading, doing anything. Not because your fate is chosen for you.
You have a choice right now. You choose. You pick. You get to do whatever you want to do. And if you want to follow his plan, you can go ahead and do that. But eventually they won't have a choice. They'll get what they want. They'll get exactly what they want. They'll be told everything they have to do, and there they are.
There they are. That's the sad thing about religion is very few people actually choose it. Now, there's some that go to a Billy Graham cult, you know, one of those big crusades, and they claim to have chosen the religion. But very few people choose it. It's mostly, this is what the father believes, and children are 80% likely to accept whatever the belief system of political and religious of the father.
Yeah.
It's why Yahweh etched that in stone. It says that children, fathers corrupt their own children to the third and fourth generation.
Yeah, but you have a choice. You can walk away from it.
I did
choose to. You did.
My father was anti-Semitic. He was mean, you know, and I walked away.
You can walk away from it. My dad is a Lutheran. He never forced me to follow him. He allowed me to question it and find my own way.
Yep.
And so you can choose to walk away from it.
Yep. In fact, that's the first requirement of participating in the covenant, walking away from your father's home. It's a requirement of the covenant. Now, that does not mean that you have to disassociate yourself from your father. He also said the first part of that was walk away from your country. Doesn't mean you have to me, I'm sitting here on the left coast trying to sell a house so that we can move back to the right coast. It doesn't mean that I need to, after lunch today, walk out into the Pacific Ocean and walk away from the United States. No, it means to disassociate in the sense of no longer participating in her politics and her militarism, her culture and her religion, and to disassociate myself from those things. Just as you needed to disassociate from the Lutheranism, Christianity of your father.
I've always looked at it like this. He wants you to walk away from things that can define you. He wants you to find yourself, and then eventually you find the covenant, and you can use that to define yourself and things like that. But if you base who you are off of the religion you are or the country you're in, those things are set up to fail. Those things are not perfect. They're not something that will be sturdy. If you build it off of what he has told us, you get a strong base and something that you can always fall back on that can't be proven wrong.
Yeah, a huge percentage of Americans define themselves as Democrats or Republicans, as patriotic. And if that's how you define yourself, if you define yourself as Christian or Catholic, then your definition of yourself is based on an institution that has deliberately misled you. And those definitions, those reliances will fail. And they won't fail some of the time. They will fail all of the time.
They're imperfect.
Yep.
They're imperfect. They have to fail.
Yep. And they're not only imperfect, they're specifically designed to mislead, every one of them. I mean, patriotism is designed to mislead. Militarism is all designed based on myths and to mislead. The politics is all about the empowerment of individuals, and they will do anything to achieve their goals, say anything to achieve their goals.
Yeah. I mean, you joke about it all the time in breaks. Whenever you say something that's anti-American, you always come in, if you don't like it, Craig, you can get out. I mean, that's who you run into. Those people, are lost.
They're lost. That's why today in the program I said, okay, now that you know this, what are you going to do? You know, now that you've been confronted with this information about how disingenuous your nation is, and for Christians, how dishonest Paul was, now that you know this information, what are you going to do? How are you going to deal with it? Are you going to go where the words lead? Are you going to accept the truth even when it means that you have to reject something that you've held dear? And when you consider what Paul just said, the only reasonable, informed, and rational response is to reject him. Now, doing so comes at a consequence. It means rejecting Christianity. It means rejecting the Christian New Testament. It means rejecting the church. It means rejecting this integration of politics and religion that is so pervasive in this country. It means walking away from many of your friends and family. But the reward, for those that do, you have the covenant. The Brilliant Mind Trust at the Pentagon came up with a name for the abominators that war on the non-Islamic Islamic State. It is inherent resolve. Inherent is an adjective. Resolve, therefore, has to be a noun. Resolve is a decision, a resolution, a commitment. Inherent means that something is an essential part of something. It's a characteristic or an attribute of it. That it's a permanent, essential characteristic or an attribute. Its synonyms would be intrinsic, innate, imminent, built in, inborn, ingrained, ingrained, deep-rooted. So a deep-rooted decision, an intrinsic resolve.
A basic decision.
That's like saying really black. Ah, gosh. Yeah. Why don't you say harebrained nonsense based upon a pile of lies that is certain to be counterproductive? There's a good name. Counterproductive and suicidal. Returning to Shaul, Paul, we don't know all the details of his life. He told us that he studied to be a rabbi, but we don't know whether he ever became one. As a young man, he claims to have studied under the famed Gamaliel, but we have no record of that, independent of his claim. This claim, by the way, would have put him in Jerusalem while Yahusha was there, but he never once shows any curiosity or claims that he listened to him or met him. It would have made it really easy for Yahusha, if he wanted Paul to be one of his disciples and apostle, to call him over and say, hey, man, you're the dude, man. You are the guy. I mean, I don't know why I messed with these other 12. You are the man. But he didn't. There is an undisclosed time thereafter that he claims to have been making tents in his hometown of Tarsus in what is now southwestern Turkey. So since there is no shortage of rabbis in Jerusalem to harass followers of the way, should that have been their unofficial mission, why not just recruit a vicious and egotistical rabbi? Why take this unbridled liberty? Why take a risk with such a man that, you know, is already perverted, already vicious, already egotistical? Why in the world would rabbis who are very much into control, maintaining the status quo, maintaining their influence, Why would they ever take a risk on this kind of an individual? That makes no sense. Well, it makes no sense, of course. Shaw was so immoral, myopic, uniquely savage, that he would have remained the wrong candidate. But when you look at this, to think that such a depraved individual would engage in such a disgusting mission where the goal was to mercilessly bludgeon your own people, ripping innocent families apart who had broken no laws only because you disagreed with their conclusions. And a moral and rational individual could never have done such a thing. So since Shaw has confessed to all of these acts and attributes, and since the attitude required to actually have done these horrendous things permeates this letter, it is incumbent upon us. It is inherent in this review to consider the character flaws that would have motivated him to do such things. Now, before we move on, returning to the passage itself, the Ecclesia describing those who were called out of the world and unto God is a translation of the Hebrew Kara, itself the basis of Mikra, the title of Yahweh's seven invitations to be called out and to meet with him. It is telling that the Ecclesia is feminine. This is because it represents Yahweh's Berith covenant, also feminine, and because inclusion in it is facilitated by the Ruach Kodesh, the set-apart spirit, the feminine manifestation of God's nature. And it is into the light of the Ruach Kodesh that we are called this evening as we celebrate the final day, the eighth day, the eternal reminder associated with Sukkah. I look forward to doing that with you. May Yah bless.